Many thanks. I'm delighted to be here in this beautiful space. This is the first time that I'm at the book club, and I'm really honored to be here. You have such a magnificent room and library, and even the books you discard are fantastic. I've just bought two. My talk is called A City Built on Books, and you will see why. In spite of the assurances of Google Maps, our geography is not defined by the detailed observation of the world we call real. Even though the possibility of spying on any remote corner of the planet has done away with the privileges of intimacy, and the universal use of a GPS has stunted our homing instincts, the world we say we know is a world made mainly out of words. We may complain about sludging through the slush of a New York winter, or boast of basking in the sunlight of a Paris cafe, but our true experiences of these places are less in the moment of our physical presence than in the pages of a Mavis Gallant story or a Simenon novel. We know of Istanbul and Timbuktu before we ever go there, if we ever go there, and Venice and London and even San Francisco are familiar to us because of our reading. A place about which nothing has been written lacks conviction. Horace pitied those kings and emperors whose reigns inspired no poems. The same could be said of towns and mountains and rivers. The imagination, biologists tell us, is a tool that our species developed in order to survive. The imagination allows us to have an experience before having it, knowing or believing we know what will happen if we sailed beyond the limits of the world like Ulysses, or we flew up to the sun like Icarus. It also fashions our sense of place and time. In spite of Copernicus, we remain convinced that the colossal galaxies swirl around this little lost corner of the cosmos in which our species happens to find itself. Unlike beauty, geography is not in the eye of the beholder, but in that of the reader of stories. Emblematic of this ancient perception is the library. The seven seas and six continents converge on our bookshelves, and the immensity of the universe is summed up for every reader in a couple of lines on a certain magical page. For each reader, the page is different, but the experience is at one time or another the same. Suddenly, without warning, we discover in a book a word, a line, a paragraph, in which what we know of the world is revealed to us in writing. All of a sudden, we can tell what it is that we feel at certain secret, emblematic moments in our life, because someone, often centuries and miles away, has put them into memorable words. In this sense, every library is universal. Our relationship to books is mainly of two kinds. For the Greeks, who assiduously wrote down their philosophical treatises, plays, poems, letters, speeches, commercial transactions, and yet regarded the written word merely as a mnemonic aid, the book was an adjunct to civilized life, never its core. For this reason, the material representation of Greek society was in space, in the stones of their cities. For the Hebrews, however, whose daily transactions were oral and whose literature was entrusted largely to memory, the book, the Bible, the revealed word of God, became the core of its civilization, surviving in time, not in space, in the migrations of a nomad people. In one of his scriptural commentaries, Saint Augustine, who comes, of course, directly from the Hebrew tradition, noted that words tend towards the quality of music, which finds its being in time and does not have any particular geographical location. Well, my laptop apparently belongs not to the book-centered Hebrew tradition of Augustine, but to the bookless Greek tradition that required monuments in stone. Even though the web simulates on my screen a borderless space, the words I conjure up owe their existence to the familiar temple of the computer, erected with its portico-like screen above the cobbled esplanade of my keyboard. Like marble for the Greeks, these plastic stones speak. In fact, thanks to their audio functions, they literally speak. And the rituals that allow me access to cyberspace is in certain ways like the rituals of access to a temple or a palace, to a symbolic place that requires preparation and learned conventions decided by invisible and seemingly all-powerful buffs. However, in this 21st century of ours, even when we build monuments in stone, we keep our books with us as we wander from here to there in our itinerant lives. Printed or electronic, we hold on to our books in order to know who we are and where we are. Since at least the times of the ancient Greeks and Hebrews, our books are our compasses. The story of Schliemann unearthing Troy because of his faithful reading of Homer repeats itself in many of our explorations. We tend to discover what we already know, and what we already know is told to us by our books. Let me tell you a story. 15th century Spain, heir not only to the rhetorical intelligence of Augustine, but also to his misogyny and racial prejudices, cast its long shadow over the bloody adventures that some call the conquest and others the invasion of the Americas. The literate and illiterate soldiers who sailed for the New World carried with them not only their mythologies and their faith, mermaids and Amazons, giants and unicorns, and also the redeeming god who is nailed to a cross in the tale of his virgin mother, but also the printed books in which these stories were recorded or retold. It is moving to read that Christopher Columbus's account of his first journey across the Atlantic tells that when he reached the coast of Guinea, the admiral saw three manatees swimming close to the ship and wrote that he saw three mermaids emerging quite visibly from the sea. But, he added with commendable honesty, they're not as beautiful as they are thought to be. Antonio Pigafetta, who traveled with Magellan on his voyage around the world, described the inhabitants of the southernmost part of the continent as patagones, or big-footed, because he thought he recognized in the tall natives dressed in boots and capes of fur the biblical Nephilim, the offspring, as Genesis says, of the gods and the daughters of men. Francisco de Orellana gave the river and the jungle of the land he explored the name of Amazon, because in the women warriors that he and his men encountered, Orellana recognized the legendary tribe described by Herodotus. All these men were readers, and their books told them what they were going to see long before they saw it. A number of these readers brought with them not only the recollection of their readings, but the physical books themselves. And when these did not suffice, they began making new ones to furnish their libraries in the new world. Juan de Zumarraga, an elderly priest, was proposed by the Spanish emperor as the bishop of the newly founded Mexico City. Named protector of the Indians, Zumarraga proceeded to burn thousands of native manuscripts and artifacts that he deemed contrary to the true faith. But at the same time, he encouraged the emperor to allow him to set up a printing press to provide the new converts with catechisms and manuals for confessors written in the native tongues. So in a literary twist that I think Henry James would have loved, the man responsible for the destruction of many of the earliest documents of the Olmec, Aztec, and Mayan civilizations was responsible as well for establishing in 1539 the first printing press of all the Americas. The earliest productions of the press included a book by Zumarraga himself, A Brief Doctrine of the Christian Faith, but also a Latin edition of the Dialectics of Aristotle and a handbook of Mexican native grammar by Alonso de Molina. Books are often wiser and more generous than their makers. The imaginary reality of books contaminates every aspect of our lives. We act and feel under the shadow of literary actions and feelings, and even the indifferent states of nature are perceived by us through literary descriptions, something John Ruskin famously called the pathetic fallacy. This contamination, this style of thought, for want of a better term, allows us to believe that the world around us is a narrative world, and that landscapes and events are part of a story that we are compelled to follow at the same time that we create it. This imaginative credulity leads us, as I have said, to unearth Troy, but also to hunt for the unicorn, of whom a Chinese bestiary tells us, "We know nothing because its shyness prevents it from appearing before human eyes." Among the stories that the Spanish explorers brought to the New World were many that dealt with fabulous kingdoms, such as the ones featured in the novels of chivalry, kingdoms in which Don Quixote was an ardent believer. If cities of gold and mountains of precious stones populated the geography of those brave imaginary epics, their emulators believed that richer golden cities and higher precious mountains would certainly exist in the strange and wonderful lands that they thought were the Indies. In 1516, the explorer Juan Díaz de Solís sailed into the River Plate, landed a handful of men on the muddy western bank, and was promptly killed and eaten by the Charrua natives. Some of the survivors continued the voyage and sailed along the coast of Brazil to a place called Santa Caterina, where a tribe of Tupi Guaraníes told them about a mysterious white king, Lord of the Silver Mountain. This seems like something out of Rider Haggard. According to their account, somewhere inland, deep in the jungle, there rose a mountain made entirely of silver. The king of that realm was known to be a generous and peace-loving monarch who would gladly give travelers part of his treasure to take away as a sign of goodwill. One of the survivors, Alejo Garcia, decided to mount an expedition to search for the fabulous kingdom. Now, Garcia managed to cross the vast green continent and reach the heights of Peru. He was killed by native arrows on the way back, but his men brought back with them to Santa Catarina a few chunks of silver ore, presumably from the area of Potosí, that were offered as proof of the truth of the story. From then onwards, the conquest of the New World was fired by the belief that a magical realm of marvelous riches lay far in the interior of the continent, ready for the picking. Alejo Garcia died in 1525. 10 years later, in 1535, an aristocratic knight, Pedro de Mendoza, who had served as chamberlain to the emperor and fought in Italy against the French, became convinced that he was the man to find the white king and dispossess him of his riches. Mendoza launched an expedition of 13 ships and 2,000 men, partly funded by himself and partly by the Emperor Charles I, who stipulated that Mendoza set up 3 Spanish fortified towns on the conquered land and within 2 years transport 1,000 Spanish colonists to inhabit them. However, after crossing the Atlantic, a terrible storm scattered Mendoza's fleet off the coast of Brazil. Natural catastrophes are often mirrored by human ones, and shortly after the storm, Mendoza's lieutenant was mysteriously murdered. These were not ideal conditions to start a colony or undertake a treasure hunt. However, on the banks of the same wide and muddy river where the natives had feasted on Solís, on February the 2nd, 1536, Mendoza founded a city he called Nuestra Señora Santa María del Buen Aire, after the patroness of Sardinia, a name that successive centuries would trim down to Buenos Aires. I mention this because I was born in Buenos Aires. Mendoza suffered from syphilis, and his intermittently confused state of mind was not conducive to an effective government. 5 years later, due to Mendoza's failings and to the belligerence of the natives, the city was abandoned. It was to be founded again some 42 years later by Juan de Garay, but in 1537, a sick and wretched man, Mendoza attempted to return to Spain, but died on the homeward journey. Now, among the crew of Mendoza's expedition was the 25-year-old son of a wealthy German merchant, Ulrich Schmidl. Schmidl was witness to the degradation and collapse of the new city and to the struggles of the colonizers to survive under the constant attacks of the natives. After the city was abandoned, he traveled up to what today is Paraguay and was present at the founding of another city, the capital of Paraguay, Asunción. And then he traveled further to Bolivia. These men crossed continents as you would cross the city. Receiving news that his elder brother had died and that he had inherited the family fortunes, Smidl asked for a discharge and returned to Europe in 1552. Now, once he returned, he wrote an account of his experiences, and based on a detailed journal that he had kept throughout the travels. The book was published in Frankfurt in 1557 under the lengthy title, in German of course, of True History of a Remarkable Voyage Undertaken by Ulrich Smidl of Straubingen in America or the New World from 1534 to 1554, where can be found all of his misfortunes of 19 years as well as a description of the lands and noteworthy people he saw there written by himself. That's the title. The book was immensely popular, and a number of translations followed into Latin, French, Spanish, and so on. Now, Schmidl's account, the first of what can be called the history of Argentina, chronicles in lurid detail the atrocious conditions of the life of Mendoza's men. Under siege by the natives, the famine became such that the colonists resorted to cannibalism. As soon as one of them was hanged for treason or for petty crime, the others hacked the body and ate it. Schmidl sheds a different light on the European conception of the cannibal savages by documenting the fact that Europeans too were capable of such acts. Montaigne, in a famous essay written at about the same time as Schmidl's chronicle, using cannibalism as his point of departure, attempted to subvert the notion of European superiority. Montaigne had met one of these so-called cannibals brought to France from the Americas by a French expedition and had in his employ a servant who had spent many years among them. These cannibals, Montaigne wrote, were not the savages we imagine, but people who lived harmoniously, respected the nature that surrounded them, and possessed all manner of technical and artistic skills. They held solid religious beliefs and lived under a perfectly efficient form of government, unlike, Montaigne says, Montaigne's fellow Frenchmen. These so-called savages, Montaigne pointed out, had no slaves, no rich and no poor, and spoke a language, this is fantastically interesting, spoke a language in which the words for treason, lying, envy, and avarice were absent. If the stories of Greece and Rome and the literature of chivalry had fed the explorer's imagination before coming to the New World as a foreword to what they would see, Schmidl and Montaigne's accounts colored the vision of the Americas in the decades that followed as a sort of afterwards to the immense saga. Now, this explains the title of my talk. Mendoza had brought with him a small collection of books that in a secret way defined perhaps the city that he had imagined. Perhaps all cities are founded with a library in mind. In any case, the books Mendoza brought with him were the following. 7 volumes of a medium size, he writes, bound in black leather, and whose titles unfortunately have not come down to us. A book by Erasmus, he says, also medium-sized and bound in the same black leather. A collection of Petrarch's poems. He describes a little book with golden covers that says inside Virgil. And a volume by a certain de Bridia, bound in vellum. Now, I had to look de Bridia up. It seems that de Bridia, and we only know the initial of his first name, which is C, was a Franciscan monk who accompanied the mission of John del Plano Caprini to Mongolia in 1247 and wrote a detailed history of the Mongol people entitled Tartar Relation. The manuscript is now in the Beneke Library. I never know how to pronounce the name of the library. Beneke Library. Thank you. Now, this modest list is wonderfully revealing because the books that Mendoza brought with him to found Buenos Aires tell us of an eclectic, generous conception, probably unconscious and certainly not explicit, of what this new city should be. In this founding library, we find a philosopher of a faith that was not Mendoza's own, Erasmus, poets in tongues other than Spanish, Petrarch and Virgil, though Mendoza's education would have included Latin, a fellow explorer from another age and another country, the far north of Tartary, opposed to the far south of the New World. All this to say that for Pedro de Mendoza, contemporary of Alonso Quijano, who believed he was Don Quixote, the world of the intellect was all one, or in other words, that any singular undertaking formed part of a universal whole. Symbolically, if not deliberately, the impulse to bring with him these books lent the identity of the city yet to be imaginative power and a sort of immortality. A sort of immortality. This is perhaps what drives in the societies of the book us to be literary nomads. Our constant migrations are pinpointed by readings, as exiles, as explorers, as refugees, as settlers. We carry books in our chattel. Our ancestors brought with them cattle, tents, grains, weapons, but also their libraries. We travel with our paperbacks or Kindles. The custom is very ancient. The people of Mesopotamia carried their trays of clay tablets to the site of new foundations to transmit the knowledge of their laws and magic rites. The Egyptian kings set up libraries in the farthest cities of their realm, and above the entrance had inscribed the words Clinic of the Soul, which Diodorus Siculus read on the majestic ruins centuries afterwards. Every library should have on above the entrance inscribed Clinic of the Soul. In the 5th century before Christ, the young Alcibiades, visiting a distant village during one of his tours of the Greek colonies, slapped the face of a teacher whose school library did not hold a single volume of Homer. 100 years later, Alexander the Great, perhaps in order not to forget that the vanquished also have a voice, always carried on his campaigns a copy of the Iliad. In the 10th century, Abdul Qasim Ismail, the Grand Vizier of Persia, to feel at home wherever he went, would transport his library of 117,000 titles on the backs of 400 camels trained to march in alphabetical order. Books help to found cities. They also help to bring our cities to mind when we are forced to leave them. Those who are driven from their homes by war, famine, sickness, and other catastrophes try to carry with them the words of their poets on paper or in their heart. In the Syrian refugee camps in Turkey, tents are set up as makeshift libraries. In Sweden, the Palestinian exiles come together to recite poetry. Mexicans who have illegally crossed into the States, escaping the violence of their country, have recreated in the suburbs of Los Angeles or Detroit their salas de lectura, improvised book clubs established throughout Mexico by ordinary readers. Stories are at the beginning of our societies and also at their end, and they provide us with an identity for the place we live in and for ourselves as individuals. The relationship between the cities we create on earth and the cities we create in the mind compete for our attention, and it is most often the imagined ones that have the upper hand. Jorge Luis Borges, in a poem entitled Mythical Foundation of Buenos Aires, summed up this relationship between the fictional and the material city in these two magical lines. I can't imagine a time when she started to be. She seems as eternal as the air and the sea. Thank you.